4 miles above the warm, flesh-coloured earth, David Morgan rode the high heavens like a young god. The sun visor of his helmet was closed, masking with its dark cyclops eye the rapt, almost mystic expression with which he flew. 5 years had not dulled the edge of his appetite for the sensation of power and isolation that flight in a Mirage interceptor awoke in him. The unfiltered sunlight blazed ferociously upon the metal of his craft, clothing him in splendor, while far below the very clouds were insignificant against the earth, scattered and flying like a sheep flock before the wolf of the wind. Today's flight was tempered by a melancholy, a sense of impending loss. The morrow was the last day of his enlistment. At noon, his commission expired, and if Paul Morgan prevailed, he would become Mr. David, new boy at Morgan Group. He thrust the thought aside and concentrated on the enjoyment of these last precious minutes. But too soon the spell was broken. Zulu Striker 1, this is Range Control. Report your position. Range Control, this is Zulu Striker. Range Control, this is Zulu Striker 1, holding up range 50 miles. Striker 1, the range is clear. Your target markers are figures 8 and 12. Commence your turn. The horizon revolved abruptly across the nose of the Mirage as the wing came over and he went down under power, falling from the heights, a controlled plunge, purposeful and precise as the stoop of a falcon. David's right hand moved swiftly across the weapon selector panel, locking in the rocket circuit. The earth flattened out ahead, immense and featureless, speckled with low bush that blurred past his wingtips as he let the Mirage sink lower. At this height, the awareness of speed was breathtaking, and as the first marker came up ahead, it seemed at the same instant to flash away below the silvery nose. 5, 6, 7, the black numerals on their glaring white grounds flickered by. A touch of left rudder and stick, both adjustments made without conscious effort, and ahead was the circular layout of the rocket range, the concentric rings shrinking in size around the central mound, the coke of flight jargon, which was the bullseye of the target. David brought the deadly machine in fast and low, his Mach meter recording a speed that was barely subsonic. He was running off the direct line of track, judging his moment with frowning concentration. When it came, he pulled the Mirage's nose into the pitch up and went over onto the target with his gloved right finger curled about the trigger lever. The shrieking silver machine achieved her correct, slightly nose-down attitude for rocket launch at the precise instant of the time that the white blob of coke was centered in the diamond patterns of the reflector sight. It was an evolution executed with subtle mastery of many diverse skills, and David pressed against the spring-loaded resistance of the trigger. There was no change in the feel of the aircraft, and the hiss of the rocket launch was almost lost beneath the howl of the great jet, but from beneath his wings the brief smoke lines reached out ahead towards the target, and in certainty of a fair strike, David pushed his throttle to the gate and waited for the rumbling ignition of his afterburners, giving him power for the climb out of range of enemy flak. What a way to go, he grinned to himself as he lay on his back, with the Mirage's nose pointed into the bright blue, and gravity pressing him into the padding of his seat. Hello, Striker 1. This is Range Control. That was right on the nose. Give the man a coke. Nice shooting. Sorry to lose you, Davy. The break in hallowed range discipline touched David. He was going to miss them. All of them. He pressed the transmit button on the molded head of his joystick and spoke into the microphone of his helmet. From Striker 1, thanks and farewell, David said. Over and out. His ground crew were waiting for him also. He shook hands with each of them, the awkward handshakes and rough jokes masking the genuine affection that the years had built between them. Then he left them and went down the vast metal-skinned cavern, redolent with the smell of grease and oil along which the gleaming rows of needle-nosed interceptors stood, even in repose their forward lines giving them speed and thrust. David paused to pat the cold metal of one of them, and the orderly found him there peering up at the emblem of the flying cobra upon the towering tailplane. CO's compliments, sir, and will you report to him right away? Colonel Rastus Nordier was a dried-out stick of a man, with a wizened monkey face, who wore his uniform and medal ribbons with a casually distracted air. He had flown Hurricanes in the Battle of Britain, Mustangs in Italy, Spitfires and Messerschmitt 109s in Palestine, and Sabres in Korea. And he was too old for his present command, but nobody could muster the courage to tell him that, especially as he could outfly and outgun most of the young bucks on the squadron.
"So we're getting rid of you at last, Morgan," he greeted David.
"Not until after the mess party, sir."
"Yeah," Rastus nodded. "You've given me enough hardship these last 5 years. You owe me a bucket of whiskey." He gestured to the hard-backed chair beside his desk. "Sit down, David."
It was the first time he had used David's given name, and David placed his flying helmet on the corner of the desk and lowered himself into the chair, clumsy in the constricting grip of his G-suit. Rastus took his time filling his pipe with the evil black Michalisberg shag, and he studied the young man opposite him intently. He recognized the same qualities in him that Paul Morgan had prized, the aggressive and competitive drive that gave him a unique value as an interceptor pilot. He lit the pipe at last, puffing thick, rank clouds of blue smoke as he slid a sheath of documents across the desk to David.
"Read and sign," he said. "That's an order."
David glanced rapidly through the papers, then he looked up and grinned. "You don't give in easily, sir," he admitted. One document was a renewal of his short service contract for an additional 5 years. The other was a warrant of promotion from captain to major.
"We've spent a great deal of time and money in making you what you are. You've been given an exceptional talent, and we have developed it until now you are, I'll not mince my words, one hell of a pilot."
"I'm sorry, sir," David told him sincerely.
"Damn it," said Rastus angrily. "Why the hell did you have to be born a Morgan? All that money, they'll clip your wings and chain you to a desk."
"It's not the money," David denied it swiftly. He felt his own anger stir at the accusation. Rastus nodded cynically.
"Yeah," he said. "I ate the stuff also."
He picked up the documents David had rejected and grunted. "Not enough to tempt you, eh?" "Colonel, it's hard to explain. I just feel that there's more to do, something important that I have to find out about, and it's not here. I have to go look for it." Rastus nodded heavily.
"All right, then," he said. "I had a good try. Now you can take your long-suffering commanding officer down to the mess and spend some of the Morgan millions on filling him up with whiskey."
He stood up and clapped his uniform cap at a rakish angle over his cropped grey head.
"You and I will get drunk together this night, for both of us are losing something. I, perhaps, more than you."
It seemed that David had inherited his love of beautiful and powerful machines from his father. Clive Morgan had driven himself, his wife, and his brand new Ferrari sports car into the side of a moving goods train at an unlit level crossing. The traffic police estimated that the Ferrari was traveling at 150 miles an hour at the moment of impact. Clive Morgan's provision for his 11-year-old son was detailed and elaborate. The child became a ward of his uncle, Paul Morgan, and his inheritance was arranged in a series of trust funds. On his majority, he was given access to the first of the funds, which provided an income equivalent to that of, say, a highly successful surgeon. On that day, the old green MG had given way to a powder blue Maserati, in true Morgan tradition. On his 23rd birthday, control of the sheep ranches in the Karoo, the cattle ranch in southwest Africa, and Jabulani, the sprawling game ranch in the Sabi Sand block, passed to him, their management handled smoothly by his trustees. On his 25th birthday, the number 2 fund interest would divert to him, in addition to a large block of negotiable paper and title in 2 massive urban holdings, office and supermarket complexes, and a high-rise housing project. At age 30, the next fund opened for him, as large as the previous 2 combined, and transfer to him of the first of 5 blocks of Morgan stock would begin. From then onwards, Every 5 years until age 50, further funds opened. Further blocks of Morgan stock would be transferred. It was a numbing procession of wealth that stretched ahead of him, daunting in its sheer magnitude. Like a display of too much rich food, it seemed to depress appetite. David drove fast southwards, with the Michelin metallics hissing savagely on the tarmac, as he thought about all that wealth, the great golden cage, the insatiable maw of Morgan Group yawning open to swallow him, so that, like the cell of a jellyfish, he would become a part of the whole, a prisoner of his own abundance. The prospect appalled him, adding a hollow sensation in his belly to the pulse of pain that beat steadily behind his eyes. Testimony to the foolhardiness of trying to drink level with Colonel Rastus Nordee. He pushed the Maserati harder, seeking the twin opiates of power and speed, finding comfort and escape in the rhythms and precision of driving very fast, and the hours flew past as swiftly as the miles, so it was still daylight when he let himself into Mitzi's apartment on the cliffs that overlooked Clifton Beach and the clear green Atlantic. Mitzi's apartment was chaos. That much had not changed. She kept open house for a string of transitory guests who drank her liquor, ate her food, and vied with each other as to who could create the most spectacular shambles. In the first bedroom that David tried, there was a strange girl with dark hair curled on the bed in boy's pajamas, sucking her thumb in sleep. With the second room, he was luckier, and he found it deserted, although the bed was unmade and someone had left breakfast dishes smeared with congealed egg upon the side table. David slung his bag on the bed and fished out his bathing costume. He changed quickly and went out by the side stairs that spiraled down to the beach and began to run. A trot at first, and then suddenly he sprinted away, racing blindly as though from some terrible monster that pursued him. At the end of Fourth Beach, where the rocks began, he plunged into the icy surf and swam out to the edge of the kelp at Buckoven Point. Driving overarm through the water and the cold lanced him to the bone, so that when he came out, he was blue and shuddering. But the hunted feeling was gone, and he warmed a little as he jogged back to Mitzi's apartment. He had to remove the forest of pantyhose and feminine underwear that festooned the bathroom before he could draw himself a bath. He filled it to the overflow, and as he settled into it, the front door burst open and Mitzi came in like the north wind. "Where are you, warrior?" She was banging the doors. "I saw your car in the garage, so I know you're here." "In here, doll," he called. And she stood in the doorway, and they grinned at each other. She had put on weight again, he saw, straining the seam of her skirt, and her bosom was bulky and amorphous under the scarlet sweater. She had finally given up her struggle with myopia, and the metal-framed spectacles sat on the end of her little nose, while her hair fuzzed out at unexpected angles. "You're beautiful," she cried, coming to kiss him, and getting soap down her sweater as she hugged him. "Drink or coffee?" she asked, and David winced at the thought of alcohol. "Coffee'll be great, doll." She brought it to him in a mug, then perched on the toilet seat. "Tell all," she commanded, and while they chatted, the pretty, dark-haired girl wandered in, still in her pajamas and bug-eyed from sleep. "This is my cousin, David. Isn't he beautiful?" Mitzi introduced them. "And this is Liz." The girl sat on the dirty linen basket in the corner and fixed David with such an awed and penetrating gaze that Mitzi warned her, "Cool it, darling. Even from here I can hear your ovaries bouncing around like ping-pong balls." But she was such a silent, ethereal little thing that they soon forgot her and talked as if they were alone. It was Mitzi who said suddenly, without preliminaries, "Papa's waiting for you, licking his lips like an Ivy League ogre. I ate with them Saturday night. He must have brought your name up 1 zillion times. It's going to be strange to have you sitting up there on top floor, in a charcoal suit, being bright at Monday morning conference." David stood up suddenly in the bath, cascading suds and steaming water, and began soaping his crotch vigorously. They watched him with interest, the dark-haired girl's eyes widening until they seemed to fill her face. David sat down again, slopping water over the edge. "I'm not going," he said, and there was a long, heavy silence. "What do you mean you're not going?" Mitzi asked timorously. "Just that," said David. "I'm not going to Morgan Group."
But you have to.
Why? Asked David. Well, I mean, it's decided. You promised Daddy that when you finished with the Air Force.
No, David said. I made no promise. He just took it.
When you said a moment ago, being bright at Monday morning conference, I knew I couldn't do it. I guess I've known all along.
Well, what are you going to do then?
Mitzi had recovered from the first shock, and her plump cheeks were tinged pink with excitement.
I don't know. I just know I'm not going to be a caretaker for other men's achievements. Morgan Group isn't me. It's something that Gramps and Dad and Uncle Paul made. It's too big and cold.
Mitzi was flushed, bright-eyed, nodding her agreement, enchanted by this prospect of rebellion and open defiance. David was warming to it also.
I'll find my own road to go. There's more to it. There has to be something more than this.
Yes, Mitzi nodded so that she almost shook her spectacles from her nose. You're not like them. You would shrivel and die up there on the executive suite.
I've got to find it, Mitzi. It's got to be out there somewhere.
David came out of the bath, his body glowing dull red-brown from the scalding water and steam rising from him in light tendrils. He pulled on a terry robe as he talked, and the two girls followed him through to the bedroom and sat side by side on the edge of the bed, eagerly nodding their encouragement as David Morgan made his formal declaration of independence. Mitzi spoiled it, however.
What are you going to tell Daddy? She asked.
The question halted David's flow of rhetoric, and he scratched the hair on his chest as he considered it. The girls waited attentively.
He's not going to let you get away again, Mitzi warned. Not without a stand-up, knock-down, drag-em-out fight.
In this moment of crisis, David's courage deserted him.
I've told him once, I don't have to tell him again.
You're just going to cut and run? Mitzi asked.
I'm not running, David replied with frosty dignity, as he picked up the pigskin folder which held his thick sheaf of credit cards from the bedside table. I'm merely reserving the right to determine my own future. He crossed to the telephone and began dialing.
Who are you calling?
The airline.
Where are you heading?
The same place as their first flight out.
I'll cover for you, declared Mitzi loyally. You're doing the right thing, warrior.
You bet I am, David agreed. My way, and screw the rest of them.
Do you have time for that? Mitzi giggled, and the dark-haired girl spoke for the first time in a husky, intense voice, without once taking her eyes off David.
I don't know about the rest of them, but may I be first, please?
With the telephone receiver to his ear, David glanced at her and realized with only mild surprise that she was in deadly earnest.